Welcome to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series.
Welcome back to the Relationship Manifesto podcast series. My name's Chris Smith, Shambles Guru on the interweb. I should record that so I don't have to keep saying it. And we're in North Thailand. I'm here with Dr. Stephen Whitehead. Stephen, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm fine. How are you?
Listeners, you like the enthusiasm. It's going to be one of those sessions, I can tell. How are you? Right, okay. actually, we were just talking about the fact that we've never had a pregnant pause in our after 30-odd podcasts. We've never sort of come to a point where what we're going to talk about now. And I was thinking, well, if we had a pregnant pause, then we could talk about pregnancies and relationships. But maybe that's another.
We can do a podcast on pregnancy and relationship, because I've, you know, had 4 kids biologically, and I've got a stepdaughter, so I know something about it. There's all sorts of issues about love, sex, bodily changes, hormones, family, moods, work. Wonderful. Certainly worth a podcast on pregnancy.
I rest my case. I rest my case. this is going to be I think this podcast is going to be a bit of a mixed bag. we don't have a theme for it. What we want to do is we want to update you on the progress of the book and share some of the experiences of actually putting an ebook together. Then we want to almost a pregnant pause. Then almost, and then we want to maybe. Talk about a couple of things that are coming up with us in our own lives and share those experiences. But actually,
I don't think you'll be sharing the experiences, Chris.
Okay. And just the experiences of those I'm watching. I've had several people contact me and say, ask him more about Tiger Woods.
Gosh. I felt so sorry for Tiger. You know, I'm not a golfer. I find it infinitely boring. It's got to be something. There's got to be something about men wanting to put little balls in holes and knocking them a long way. Oh. I can certainly come up with some phallic or subconscious gender symbolism to all that. But that aside, Tiger Woods, awesome sportsman, someone you've got to respect. So he has sex with a lot of women. Why not? You know, he's a good-looking guy. He's got money. He's got time. He's got. He's attractive in many ways in his character. It would be unusual if he didn't. He's married. Okay, so there's a problem, but that's only a problem because of his relationship with his wife. You know, there's many relationships which are where that the monogamous bit has been contracted out. And maybe where Tiger went wrong, Tiger and his wife went wrong, was not contracting out the monogamy bit. So that, you know, they've gone full headlong into the traditional, constraining, limiting, predictable monogamous relationship, marriage, happy ever after. And then, of course, it's not quite like that. What Tiger's doing is doing what men and women down the ages of doing, is taking opportunities for sexual pleasure outside of his love relationship. There's nothing that I've seen, and you know, anybody listening to this can put me right on this, there's nothing I've seen in the press that suggests Tiger Woods was in love, was going to leave his wife, and it was always in a love relationship. He loved his wife. He just wanted sex with other women. Why not? Come on, guys. There's guys listening to this around the world nodding, and I know you're nodding. And if you're not nodding, it's because your wife or girlfriend's there at the time watching you or listening to you. You know as well as I do.
But hadn't Bill Clinton already set the guidelines by saying that actually a blowjob doesn't count as sex? Did he actually say that?
He did stand
up at the time, I think. Yes.
The point, he said, I did not have sex with that woman, Monica Lewinsky, didn't he? And his concept of, or his definition of sex was, he was drawing on the traditional, you know, the stereotypical definition of sex, where it's penetrative sex, where it's cock and vagina. what he had apparently was a blowjob, but so was that sex? Again, it's how you define it.
I'm sorry. I am not here
to say that a blowjob is or is not sex. I mean, people can make that up for themselves. There doesn't have to be a definitive definition about this. It's what you work out for yourselves, and that comes back to Tiger Woods' thing. It's what Tiger Woods worked out with his wife. Now, his wife expected monogamy. She expected happy ever after, monogamy, no other women. Sorry, Mrs. Woods, you're unrealistic.
Disneyland style.
Absolutely. Not going to happen. Yes. So now you get over it. Now, I don't know where they are with the relationship. Maybe they've got divorce, whatever. Maybe they're in some happy land. I don't know. But I know for sure, certainly from reading what I read in the press and the media, was that Tiger Woods went through some sex addiction counselling. That then creates in me a feeling I want to stand up in for Tiger and say, Tiger, just don't do this. I know you can afford it, just don't bother. Because you're going to immediately, the only reason you can even begin that process of undergoing sex addiction counselling is to begin by having guilt about it. You have to be, what their counsellors will insist you do is recognise you did something wrong. You cannot begin to do that unless you bring in guilt or shame. I'm saying stay away from that, because they are all counterproductive. They're not good for you as a person. They're probably not good for you as a golfer. They're certainly not good for you as a husband and father. Stay away from it. It's a form of mental manipulation. And the only people who really benefit from it are the people who you're paying, the sex addiction counsellors, a lot of money to make you feel guilty, and you'll go back and, you know, you go back and you promise not to do it again, or you reflect on your behaviour. When you see some attractive woman in the street and you feel the hormones kicking in and you want to go and talk or connect, or you flirt a bit, you know, the guilt thing kicks in. You know, we've had 2,000 years of Catholicism with, you know, doing this, and just don't go there.
So is sex addiction an illness?
Sex addiction.
Can you get a shot for it?
There's no such thing. The concept is created by society. It's created by society. It doesn't exist. It's a figment of our imagination. It's constructed by a society, particularly an American society, a North American society, that's completely hung up on sex. They're trying to impose, societies are trying to impose a rigid, traditional, monogamous pattern, condition of behaviour, which, you know, it's not working. Monogamy does not work. There's billions of people out there, as I'm speaking now, in their actions with an anonymous lover, proving that monogamy is a fiction.
Mm.
It works for a few people. I know it works for a few people. Viva la difference. Don't impose it on everybody else. It does not work for everybody.
Mm.
For most people, it does not work at all.
Yes.
And there are some people who are like the Tiger, young, attractive, moneyed, free. Free in terms of social mobility.
Alone in hotels, travelling.
Of course.
Yes.
You know what? Where are we? Why we got these sex addiction counsellors out there in the first place? We've got them out there because we've got a guilt-ridden society about sex. So, you know, de facto we end up with some counsellor comes along and says, I will cure you of your addiction. Come on. You know, Tiger Woods will be cured of his addiction to sex with women maybe when he's about 85, 90, perhaps. Even maybe not even then. I don't know. I don't care. He can do what he likes. It's up to him and the people he's doing it with. Yes. As long as it's, as I say before, as long as it's consensual, that's the issue.
I know very little about this particular situation. I didn't even read much about it at the time.
Well, Tiger Woods exemplifies something that's been going, this been developing in American society for some time now, for at least a decade.
Yes.
Michael Douglas was another one. Now, okay, I'm sure his beautiful wife, I forget her name now, I know she's Welsh, had a lot, maybe she had some issues about that, no doubt, and with reason. But that's an issue for him and her. You want a relationship counsellor? Fine.
Mm.
You bring an anonymous third party in to give you their opinion? Fine. That's okay. But to then posit on these men some pathological condition which needs psychological, psychoanalytical help, that I've got an issue with.
Mm.
Because immediately we do that, we're into the issue of, or the area of sex, some aspects of sex being abnormal. It's just different.
Mm.
As long as it's with consenting adults. Mm. Now, if we're into children, that's a different issue. If we're into sex trafficking, abuse, murder, violence, that's a different issue. But if we're into adults, consensual sex between adults, what is the problem?
Mm.
The problem is only with society's structures and rigid boundaries that have been imposed over time.
Mm.
That's what Tiger Woods and his wife were suffering from. Maybe Tiger should never have got married. Maybe if he was to come back again in another life as Tiger Woods, maybe he'd think twice about getting married. And if he did get married, maybe he'd go in for a polyamorous relationship.
Mm.
A relationship where there's a negotiated sexual activity outside of that couple.
Yes.
And it's happening all over the world now. And it's happening a lot in America.
Mm.
Go for it. Fine. But you... They got trapped. They got caught by this, by the press. They got caught they by got the caught. Press.
And they didn't just full stop. Yeah, they got caught. Sure. That was a mistake.
That's right. He got caught. But you know, if there's nothing to be caught, if he'd been open with his wife about his needs, and not to try and diminish his needs or control his needs or pretend his needs are suddenly going to go away. If he'd been open with his wife about his needs, and if his wife can't cope, then okay, you split up.
Yes.
Because he's got to be strong enough to face the consequences of his desires.
Yes.
But to pretend that he can suddenly counsel his desires away, it's like the stupid situation where you get where people come along and claim they can counsel gay and lesbian people. To be straight, I have to laugh. I mean, how bizarre is that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. You just don't. It's damaging. It's nasty. You know, we don't need it. Mm. So, sex addiction is part of that domain of professionals interfering and causing more problems.
Yeah. Difficult to talk about for me to talk about Tiger Woods because I don't really know much what's going on there. I do wonder though whether. You know, some of his reactions are because he's being asked to jump through hoops for the sake of potential sponsors.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm sure there's that aspect. And
I'm sure that's the case. Well, then he'll have to face up to that. If he's prepared to... And I'll go, okay, Tiger, I'm going to put it hard to you. You were prepared to sell your desires for the sake of money. That's up to you.
Mm.
If you're prepared to compromise something that's... fundamental to your very personality, to your very being, for the sake of more millions, and you've already got millions, okay, so be it.
Yes.
I haven't got a lot of sympathy with you in that situation.
Yes.
Because you've already got a good life. You don't need more money. You can still be a good golfer. You can still be the world-class sportsman. If you're prepared to compromise in order to get even more money, compromise something that's fundamental to your very identity, to your way of being in the world, okay, do it. But frankly, it's not an impressive move.
Mm. Yes, interesting. Mr. and Mrs. Woods are listening to this. I suspect that's highly unlikely. I do actually know what the problem was. It's a very simple one. Had you read the relationship manifesto before you actually got that's married, right. Then all of this would never have happened. Is that right?
One thing, if they'd read the relationship manifesto before they got married and committed to the vows, then they'd have been okay. Because then they would have had a forewarning of what might come down the line, and they would have been able to possibly deal with it before it became a full-blown media circus out there where every Tom, Dick and Harry around the world knew about it. Similarly with Bill Clinton and others like it. You know, that's why one of my motivations for writing the book was to get out there a different pattern, a different understanding, and also a different set of rules, if you like, Because the relationship manifesto vows, they're rules if you for the 21st century. Mm. If you can follow them, then you're likely to have a more open relationship. Yes. You certainly will have a more open relationship. And the relationship's more equal, balanced, and conducive to change.
Well, we did say we'd give an update on the book. Can we update listeners to where we are with the book? It's been a really interesting journey for me, as well as producing the podcast series. And Stephen's written the book. The book was finished in the summer. We're in 2011 now. If you're listening to this at some date in the far distance, and which is quite likely. And it's been interesting because what do we do with it? Stephen has an agent in London, and there's the traditional channels to go through. But we looked at producing an ebook, and that's 95% finished now. Now, what is interesting is, in my doing the sort of mechanical authoring of the book, is that we wanted it to be multimedia. So as well as the original text there, which of course is the main part of the book, it is a bit like a birthday cake. You have some icing on it as well as the actual the fruity bits in the middle. And I should have turned my phone off. Oh, my goodness. Okay, we will leave that there. And so actually each chapter has audio sections to it as well that you can listen to. And we structured it so that there's at least two audio sections in each of the seven chapters. One of them is really pushing the chapter a little bit, Stephen talking for 3 or 4 minutes and pushing a few other things. But the other thing we wanted to put was to have Stephen actually asking you, the reader, some particular questions that might be appropriate now that you've read that particular chapter. So we have that. We've also put a couple of videos in, which has been like taking Stephen to the dentist.
Oh, awful.
It's awful. It's he's so relaxed here, but put him in front of a camera, and it's like going to the dentist. But they're not. The video sections aren't very, very much. There's an introduction, saying a little bit about himself, really, and then a thanks for reading it at the end. But trust me, I'm keeping the outtakes, and maybe we'll have we'll have one of those blooper type TV series afterwards. It's that's interesting. What was another interesting part of putting the book together, and maybe I'll blog about what equipment and what software I used to put it together, and how we get to get it to go into Amazon, and how we get it to go into iTunes, and wherever it might else it might go. But one of the other interesting parts was we wanted to choose some images, some graphics for each chapter, and so that's been quite fun. Taking each chapter and finding a particular photograph to put at the front of it, which we feel is illustrative of the chapter itself. Now, I haven't told Stephen this, but there is a photograph that I want to put at the very end, but he may not like me putting it there, so it may not appear in the final book. There's a photograph I found, which is a middle-aged woman sitting next to a guy on a park bench, but the guy is actually a skeleton. Mm-hmm. And I think this just illustrates the fact that you've now programmed me to think that the human male species, our days are numbered. And whether we put this photograph in the book or not, I
assume it's a male skeleton. How do you know?
Oh, you can tell.
Oh, you can tell, can you?
You can tell it's a male skeleton. I'm thinking on my feet here. Right, I'll have another look at the photograph.
Oh, good. Yeah.
No, there's a rib missing. Oh, there's an extra rib there. Okay. You can tell from that.
All right.
Oh, God, I trust you to ask something like that. So anyway, that's the state of the book. Anything you want to add about that, Stephen? It's been a bit of a learning journey for you as well about the use of ebooks and the format of ebooks, hasn't it?
I think the whole issue about publications now is very liberating for many writers. They don't have to go necessarily through an agent. They don't necessarily have to go through a major publisher to get out in the public domain. Whether that's a good thing, well, it means more people getting out there writing. That's a good thing. The health warning on it, well, there's going to be a lot of dross out there that people will have to wade through in order to get some gems, because in the traditional way of doing writing, you wouldn't get published, and certainly with a popular book, fiction or non-fiction, unless it went through an agent, and that agent themselves will be a filter, a quality filter, and then there would be the additional filter, the key one, which will be the publisher themselves, who would also ascertain whether this book had any mileage. Now, publishers don't always get it right. They often make mistakes. They often fail to see a good book that's going to do well, and there's many examples of that. And they often, publishers will maybe plough money into some politicians' memoirs, which are instantly forgettable and boring, and fail to back financially some brilliant piece of fiction by some unknown writer. So the publishers aren't perfect, and that's where the ebook comes in, because it does offer everybody out there, if you've got a book idea, you can get it out in the public domain, as long as but you still got to write it, and you've got to be committed to that, and writing is a skill and it takes time.
I could never write a book. It's a discipline as well as a skill, isn't it?
Yeah,
and when you're writing it, do you sort of wake up at 8 a.m. and say, "I'm going to do 2 hours"?
Sometimes I might do that. I might wake up with an idea. If I'm in the middle of writing a book, and I'm on stream with the book, and I've got first chapters on the go, and I need to, or a chapter on the go, I need to. I could well wake up early and start writing at 8 a.m. and do 2 or 3 hours, 4 hours. Different writers have the different times of the day when they're more productive. Mm-hmm. Mine tends to be in the morning, though. Mm-hmm. It has been times in the past when I was younger, I could work right through till 4 or 5 o'clock. I'd not like to do that now. But nevertheless, you can get out and you find your own time for writing. Mm-hmm. It is productive. It's a challenge, and people don't find it easy. I mean, I've got many students who I'm supervising through PhDs and MAs and MBAs who are writing theses of 10, 20, 60, 70,000 words, depending on the qualification they're in, and they find it hard. Mm. You know, to write something solid that's coherent, well structured, well organized, well grounded in the literature is not easy to do. But that's academic work. Mm. To write, I can't personally write fiction, it's not my forte, so I tend to stay away from it. But non-fiction, where you've got a basis, a solid knowledge base, and you just need to structure it and bring it out. I mean, like with Ali's biography, that shouldn't be too difficult for me because I've got the material there. The challenge will be presenting Ali's story in a way that captures the imagination and of the reader and resonates with the reader. And that will be the trick.
And it's digestible.
And it's digestible
in a readable way.
Yeah, and it's accessible. That is one thing. And I think many academic writers lose accessibility because if you're only ever writing academic books for an academic audience, and I can think of some names now, you just would not want to be reading their work. Michel Foucault, Wittgenstein, Judith Butler.
Because
the work is so dense, you get a headache reading it. Leotard's another one. It's just densely written prose that is very, very difficult to get through and understand. It's very, very intellectual, highly difficult to piece together and get the full meaning of it, grasp the meaning. So often, what students do, they'll read derivatives of those key writers. Publishers will come out with derivative books written by someone who's not known but who's succinctly encapsulates the main themes of arguments by a particular named sociologist, psychoanalyst or whatever. That's what happens. You become you do academic writing, eventually you're certainly not going to attract a popular audience. Very few. There are some exceptions to that, but not many.
Yes.
And that's one reason why I went into popular writing back in 2003. I wanted to keep that major audience if I could. So you try and straddle both camps, both genres, the serious academic non-fiction, theoretical non-fiction, and for me the more popular, slightly less serious, but still hopefully insightful non-fiction, and in my area about sex, gender and relationships.
Yes. One of the things about e-books that I quite like, or iBooks if you're an Apple person, is that with most of the readers, whether you're looking at it on a Kindle or you're looking at it on an iPad or if you've got good eyesight on an iPhone or a smartphone, is the way you can actually take ownership of an ebook by, well, you could always, with a paperback traditional book, write in the margins anyway, and you can do the same things with an ebook. You can mark it, you can leave notes down the side, and so you can actually customize it quite considerably to include and add your own thoughts. One of the problems the industry is presenting us with now, though, is if you customize your ebook in that way, it's very difficult to share that with somebody else because of digital DRM, digital rights management. And but maybe that will be solved in sometime in the future. We have a date. We're hoping that it will be in the Amazon store on the 5th of November. Those living in Britain will understand the significance of the 5th of November. Guy Fawkes tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament on that date, so we thought that was rather an apt date.
Not that we want to blow up the Houses of Parliament.
But it's easy for us to remember.
Yeah, it's easy to remember. Yeah.
So that's where we are with the book. It's multimedia, and I'm quite excited. I'm excited. We're both excited about it, aren't we?
I'm excited. I'm delighted it's got out, yeah. And it's been a great project. I like books. I mean, Chris and I are slightly different here because he's into yes. the Kindle iTunes thing. Me, I like to feel a book. It's almost sensual. To feel a book and have the books on the shelves. And, you know, if you're an academic or even if you're a student and you're at university, Kindle's going to absolutely no use to, because you need, well, it will be a use because you can read one book at a time. But if you write, you know, and I, students out there, professors out there, academics out there, researchers out there, you know, you've got to have about 5 or 6 books on the go in front of you in the table to be able to write your essay, to write your chapter. You can't do that with Kindle. You've got one at a time. But
and I've never ever thought about that perspective. Yeah, I was going to come back at you at that, but actually, that's not
you,
a bad
you need
perspective.
It. Interesting. You've got to have a number of books, and you've got to go to any academic will tell you. You go into any academic's office, any professor's office, anywhere in any university in the world, and what you're going to see is books.
Yes,
lots of books. And the student talks to you. They've got an issue. You go to the book. You get it down. You pick out the chapter. You pick out the page. Pick out the reference. You've got it all there immediately. Kindle can't replace that.
No, it can replace that. But what I do accept from you is that scenario where you're sat at the desk with several books open around you at the same time and you're multitasking between those books. It's not impossible to do it, but it's very difficult
to do
that.
Believe me, you couldn't. Having written a PhD in 10 books, you need the other material around. You need the resources. And it's not just books, it's also... it might be books, it might be book chapters, it might be journal articles, and you might draw on the internet. Absolutely, you've got your computer and that's got information and resources, and you have your Kindle as well. But you need the other books in order to pull together all the ideas, because it's not just reading one book. you won't be able to produce an academic piece of work with just one resource. You might need it. I mean, on my book that's coming out next year with Roy Moodley, who's Hi Roy, at Toronto University, this book called Gender and Identity with Oxford University Press, we've got about 800 references. Now, they've not all been books we've read. Some of them are newspaper articles, some of them are internet, some of them are journal articles, but they're all out there in the public domain. And at times when I was writing that book with Roy, you know, I would have 7 or 8 books around me. I'm writing just one chapter. Maybe just one aspect of one chapter. I would need to draw on a number of different resources in order to pull it together.
And you have them physically out on the desk.
You've got to be physically out on the desk because you've got to look at a concept. You might, I'm not going to bore the listener with the different concepts, but there might be one concept which is very limited within an aspect of sociology. And I've got to go to that concept and I want to see what other people have written about it, how it links with another concept. Because you're developing new knowledge, if you like, or succinctly putting together new, different way of understanding current knowledge. So yeah, you need more than one.
Stephen, you just sent me off on a tangent I'd not thought about before. That's a particular 21st century multitasking learning skill. I will have more interesting discussions with people about that. That's quite an interesting one, is how ebooks can be used in that multitasking way. Mind you, if Kindle and Amazon go the way they're going, they're making them so cheap now, they're almost giving them away free. somebody, some cartoonist out there is going to write, is going to draw the cartoon with half a dozen Kindles around the desk.
Mm. Well, if they're free, I mean, a student who's already burdened with student debt and little income, they're welcome free Kindles.
And they're down to $70 now, I think. It's quite
and
amazing.
There is the advantage of the student, of course, in university is if they've got six or seven Kindles, they can draw on and have six or seven books out at any one time. It's saving them to go to the university library. Because the libraries themselves are often overused and students can't get access to the books that they want. But yeah, that's just it. Back to the subject of our ebook. I mean, it comes out as an ebook and it just enables it to get into a wider audience.
But it's still not a very popular
format.
It's still not unlikely. It's still not impossible that it comes out in a traditional dead tree format, right? It could still come out on paper.
We're still going down that avenue.
And it would be nice. And one doesn't rule out the other.
No, that's right. Yeah,
providing you don't sign that contract that says exclusivity. Right?
No, careful what you sign.
Careful contract. So anyway, that's the book, ladies and gents. We're going for the 5th of November, but who knows? You never know. Now, to finish off, last few minutes to finish off, we're actually recording this podcast a few days early because we're both, ironically enough, coincidentally, we're both going to be in Bangkok when this is published, this podcast. I'm there for a teacher's conference it's a brilliant teacher's conference called TechX 2011. If you want to know about it, you just type in TCHEX 2011. And it's a two-day conference, and there'll be about 500 teachers there from international schools. And it'll have an educational technology focus. Hey, this is a free advert for TEDx. I hope you appreciate it. Not TEDx, TechX. And there'll be about 500 teachers there from international schools, all sharing. It's not gurus on the stage. It's teachers sharing with teachers. And I've been to it before, and they've invited me down again to run some workshops, and I'm really looking forward to that. So I'll be in Bangkok, if you're listening to this when it's published. And Stephen, coincidentally, what will you be doing in Bangkok, Stephen?
Well, I've got my MBA Education International Program, which is hosted at Harrow International School in Bangkok, near Domrawang Airport. I'll have my students there for residential. And my colleague from Keele University, Professor Steve Cropper, will be over to join me on that residential next weekend. So I think for Steve Cropper, hi Steve, if you listen to this, it's your first time proper in Bangkok, because every time you've come to Thailand, you've tripped up here to Chiang Mai. And this is your first time in Bangkok, you're into a whole different world, as you'll quickly see.
And that's going to be my question.
Oh, is it?
This is going to be my question, is with this podcast series called The Relationship Manifesto.
Mm-hmm.
And in the same sentence, we have the word Bangkok.
Mm-hmm. Place.
What? Yeah. So relationships and Bangkok. What image is appearing in your mind now, Mr.
Well, the first image that comes to mind is the image that I first had of Bangkok long before I actually landed in Bangkok, and that was 10 years ago. And it was an image of scantily clad women on bars dancing to some, rock music. And you know, it's that image still is conjured up for me in Bangkok. I mean, okay, Bangkok's a lot more than that. I can think of the Chao Phraya River. I can think of the massive hotels, the Shangri-La, the Peninsula, the Oriental. I can think of Sukhumvit Road and the overhead railway and the teeming masses that you've got in that city of maybe, I don't know, 15 million people.
I'd add to that the humidity. It's the rainy season now. It's going to be humid. We're going to sweat. Yeah. And it would be the smells. I mean, in the nice way actually, there are some bad smells, but the food and the...
Yeah,
and
it's a wonderful city. Yeah. For me, it's the most exciting city in the world, and I've been to many, and Bangkok's just unique. It knocks spots off most other cities. I mean, I was in Shanghai the other month, and Shanghai just pales into insignificance compared to Bangkok, frankly. No, Bangkok's the place. What was the question about relationships?
Well, no, I was just wondering if you put the term relationships and Bangkok in the same sentence.
I wouldn't know.
What image is there? Yeah, we have touched on this before.
The images of images of relationships in Bangkok are, one image that comes to mind is the big 6'4" Westerner, probably an American, if he's that big, weighing about 17 stone, arm in arm with some demure little Thai lady who's about 5'3". We blow away with a wisp, and they're walking hand in hand down, you know, and going to Siam Paragon for a meal. Loads of all that. The go-go girl, go-go bar girls, the sex tourist industry of the Bangkok, but also all the other paraphernalia of it all. The relationships in Bangkok, it's a place to go and meet someone, whatever sex you are, whether you're into gay or lesbian or transsexual sex. If you want to meet Katoya, then go to Bangkok. If you want to meet some beautiful young Thai woman, go to Bangkok. If you want to meet someone, if you're a Westerner and you want to meet a Western man or woman in Bangkok, then that's less much less likely. Stay where you are.
But there are places to go, aren't there? There are, and we mentioned this term before, there are expat bubbles.
Yeah, there are expat bubbles. Most expats who will go somewhere like Bangkok, if they've gone out with a lover, a wife, or a husband, or boyfriend or woman friend or whatever, they may well feel that there's a lot of opportunities being missed because they're in a committed relationship. Tiger, do not go to Bangkok.
But he's partly Thai, isn't his mother?
He's
Thai?
Part his mother's Thai, yeah. His mother's Thai. And that's part of, he's such a good looking guy. The Western, or in his case, the African and Thai mix, it's just beautiful, a very good looking guy. It's all available in Bangkok. I think one thing I will be doing with my students, some of whom already work and live in Bangkok, so they're not a problem. But for those students who are coming on my MBA residential next weekend, we won't be going out into the city on the days of the residential. We won't be going out far because I don't want anybody distracted. I want them focused on. Be on top.
What a sport.
I am, yeah. I'm a teacher.
You don't want them with hangovers the next morning.
I don't want them with
hangovers,
and I don't want them coming back late.
Sorry, MBA students. You thought you were going to have a good time, didn't you? Sorry about that.
This is coming out. This podcast is coming out
on the day it starts, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But you keep it on topic and keep it focused. I mean, Bangkok's a great city, and I say it's a wonderful place to be. But in terms of relationships, it can be a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the place that you find. Your existing relationships gets threatened, undermined. Would it be a place where you would feel your current relationship gets reinforced? I don't know. It's a city of temptations. You know it, Chris, as well as I. It's a city of temptations, and they're on every corner.
I refuse to answer that on the grounds I may incriminate myself. It's Stephen. What will you be? So your colleague who's coming out from Kiel. Is that right?
Yeah, Steve Cropper.
So, so what's in store for Steve after the course
he's
is over?
He's just going to work.
I'm sorry, Steve.
He's just working. We've got a full on itinerary. A lot of work on. We'll go out to some restaurants. We'll show him around Bangkok, but we'll stay in the taxi.
Hey, folks, he's hesitating. Can you hear the hesitation in the voice? He's not. We've touched a topic. He's not going to.
We're not going to be getting out of the taxi.
Maybe this is a good place to stop the podcast. So when this comes out, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, so we'll be working our socks off. In Bangkok and probably not thinking about. Podcast series at all. Hope you've enjoyed this. It's been a bit of a mixed bag, and I think what we'll do is in future podcasts is now we'll try and get back to looking at specific topics. Feel free to contact us again, and actually we both quite pleased with the responses we're getting, aren't we? We're getting emails from different people around the world, and
definitely want to do one on pregnancy because.
Maybe that might be the next one then.
Yeah, definitely want to do on pregnancy.
The pregnancy and relationships.
So much I can tell you about pregnancies, about not b- being pregnant, but about the relationships, the issues that kick in during pregnancy.
And the following the pregnant pause. Okay, we've got the topic for the next podcast, ladies and gents. I hope you enjoyed that, and see you in a week's time. Have fun. See you, Stephen.
Bye.
This recording is part of a Relationship Manifesto podcast series with Chris Smith and Stephen Whitehead.